Welcome back to Open Line. In this hour, we turn our attention to connecting with people in the far corners of the world. Public radio and NPR travel expert Rick Steves has explored many places that the rest of us only read about. He says the experience has broadened his perspective and taught him some important lessons, and that if we choose our destinations well and keep an open mind, the same can happen for us. He has put his thoughts into a book called Travel as a Political Act, and he joins us now to share some of his insights. Rick, it's great to have you on Open Line.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Charlene.
You're such a veteran traveler. You make it seem really easy to travel to really out-of-the-way places that most of us might not consider. Is it?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people think, are you talking about going to Afghanistan or someplace really dangerous? And I'm really not. I'm talking about going to Mazatlan, but then checking out Managua also. Or I'm talking about going to Dubrovnik and waiting in line with all the cruise travelers, but then heading inland for 2 hours to Bosnia, which is recovering from a war. When we travel, when we leave our country, we're very close to opportunities where we can shake up our understanding of this world. And I just think it's so important to realize that we're a beautiful 4% of this planet, but there's a 96% of humanity out there that finds different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And when you travel, you realize that's not a threatening thing. That's a beautiful thing. And it just makes a lot of sense to respect other people's ways of living and give everybody a little wiggle room, and we can share this planet together.
The process actually starts with where you choose to go.
Well, it's true. A few years ago, my wife and kids and I needed a good vacation on the beach, so we were thinking about going down to Mazatlan. And then I was invited to go to El Salvador to remember the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. Mm-hmm. Well, I told my wife, I'm not going to be any fun on the beach, and I've got to go to El Salvador. And I went there, and it was a different kind of vacation. It was just as easy to get there. It was cheaper to be there, of course. And I was having the most fascinating, broadening, challenging time, and it just carbonated my whole understanding of what's south of our border. I was hanging out with priests and nuns who were excommunicated by the church, and they were still doing their priest and nun work. What's the deal? Well, they told me part of their vow of obedience to the church is disobedience to the church with a capital C. I was going to a memorial in the city with thousands of local people, and the memorial looked exactly like a knockoff of our Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., with thousands of names chiseled onto the black granite. And then I realized each of those names was the name of a loved one who died fighting my country. And I saw people tenderly fingering those letters of their lost loved one's name, and I thought, wow, this is powerful stuff. I wouldn't have known that. Now, maybe those were all evil people that needed to be killed, but I needed to go down there and meet those people. Now, when I go to El Salvador, I know it's dollarized. I know they don't have their own currency anymore. They've got nickels and quarters, and they've got Thomas Jefferson and George Washington mm-hmm. rattling around in their coin boxes, you know. It's a fascinating world, and when we travel, I think it's a little bit against the industry, against what people want you to do to smarten yourself up. They want to dumb you down so you'll just have fun in the sun and the beach and focus on duty-free shopping and frequent flyer miles. But there's much more important things to travel than that, and the industry's not going to encourage you that way because the industry makes no money off you when you talk to people instead of go shopping on the beach.
So how do you make your choices? Do you just open up the map and say, I haven't been here or here, and just shut your eyes and pick one, or is there a method to the madness?
Well, you have to have some curiosity. I was just in Switzerland, and, when you go to Switzerland, you can see the folk show on stage with a bunch of tour bus people gathered together and take the ride to the top of the mountain. Or you can go to a heroin maintenance clinic. I was in Zurich and went down at a coffee shop into the bathroom, and the lights were blue when I went into the bathroom. What's the deal? I couldn't find my veins. The guys who run coffee shops don't want junkies shooting up in their bathrooms in Zurich. Well, tell me more. And across the street, there's a machine bolted to a railing that used to sell cigarettes, and now it sells government-subsidized syringes. This is right in the street in Zurich. I've been there for 20 years, and I never noticed this. And then down the street, there's a heroin maintenance clinic. So I talked to people about that, and I realized, in Europe, they treat their drug abuse problems as health problems rather than criminal problems, and they've got a chance to take the crime out of it and let these unfortunate people whose lives are all messed up by drug abuse to talk with nurses and counselors and get their fix without the terror of wondering where am I going to get it and how can I afford it. And the consequence is their drug addicts are on the streets, which kind of makes a lot of American tourists nervous and think, don't these liberals know how to lock up their drug addicts? But their drug addicts are on the mend. They're going to counseling. They're getting off drugs and back into the workforce, and they're not in jail, and they're not dead. We lose 2.5 times as many people per capita to drug problems as Europe does, and they've got no drug addicts in prison. So, you know, there's just different approaches to things. And when I go to Zurich or Switzerland, I learn about a pragmatic approach to drug abuse. When I go to Scandinavia, I learn about more of a socialistic sensibility when it comes to healthcare and education. When I go to Greece, I talk to a man who spent 20 years working in New York, and like many Greeks do when they retire, they go back to the old country. And he told me, when I was in America, it never occurred to me to take a nap, and I didn't realize that until I got home. Now when I want to take a nap, I do. You see, that's just all fun stuff that's right there for us to take, but the industry dumbs us down and encourages us just to go shopping and see the goofy cliches on stage. The industry is all designed for people who just are so excited that they can eat 5 meals a day and still snorkel when they get into port. And I think there's more to travel than that.
Well, and Rick, isn't part of it just that you have to be willing to talk to people and be open to chance encounters with things like your experience in Zurich and stumble across something and pursue it a little bit?
Well, very much so, yeah. You know, I'm for 25 years, I was a tour guide. And we still take 300 groups around Europe every year in my company. And for 20 years, I've been making TV shows for public television. And for 30 years, I've been writing guidebooks. In all three of those jobs, tour guide, TV host, and guidebook writer, if I'm not connecting people to people, I know the travel experience is going to be flat. And I get quite stressed out when I'm making a TV show if I don't have friends that I can connect with and make the travel experience more vivid and more real. As a tour guide, I'm on the spot. I've got to connect my people with the culture. I used to take groups around Eastern Turkey. And when you go to Eastern Turkey, you don't have a list of famous sites. There just aren't famous sites in Eastern Turkey. It's a cultural scavenger hunt. And if you see 300 high school kids in a stadium, you stop the bus, you go in, and you see what's happening. So we stopped the bus, went in, and 300 kids were thrusting their fists up in the air, screaming, "We are a secular nation," in unison. "We are a secular nation." I asked my guide, "What's going on? Don't they like God?" And she said, "No, we love God here in Turkey, but we are very concerned with the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism given what's going on over the border in Iran." Oh, now I realize that Turkey, I talk more, and I realize that Turkey has a precious and fragile separation of mosque and state, and their military is obligated, according to their constitution, to overthrow their government, their own government, if ever it becomes a theocracy. I didn't realize that there was a threatened separation of mosque and state for 70 million Turkish people, and now my understanding of that whole challenge in that area is a little more deep, and that's because I'm traveling with an eye for learning about people's struggles, and that really is travel as a political act.
And that's what you mean by the title, is to seek out that sort of thing.
Yeah, and my concern is that the industry, it's subversive in the industry because there's no easy money. I mean, the biggest industry on this planet is either armaments or tourism, depending on how you measure it, and tourism is a huge employer, and they want you just to be dumbed down and go shopping, you know? And there's nothing wrong with relaxing and recreating and having fun in the sun on the beach. But I think a lot of Americans are more curious than that, and they need somebody to encourage them and inspire them when they're traveling to be talking to people. I'm with my Dutch friends, and we start talking about social issues, and they say they start talking about how many people we lock up in our society. And they tell me, "You lock up 8 times the people we do per capita, and either there's something inherently bad about Americans or your system is messed up." And they say, "Here in the Netherlands, we have a philosophy that a society has to make a choice, tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons." Now, they're not right necessarily, and we're not wrong necessarily, but it really is exciting to travel around and meet smart people who have nowhere near the affluence or opportunity or freedom that I may have, who find different truths to be self-evident. And you know, until well into my adult life, I really thought the world was a pyramid with us on top and everybody else trying to get there. And it was only after I traveled that I realized you know, people don't have the American dream. They've got a different dream. They've got the Moroccan dream or the Sri Lankan dream or the Norwegian dream. And that's a beautiful thing. That's nothing to, you know, that's not an unpatriotic sentiment. That's just the reality of this planet. And it's, I believe it's something to celebrate. And I'm thankful for my travels, you know, for that outlook that I have.
And frankly, so are we, because we can hear you on Travel with Rick Steves here on WOSU 820 AM on Sunday afternoons at 1 o'clock and also on WOSU television at various times in the schedule. We can see Rick Steves Europe. So we appreciate having that.
I sure appreciate that. That gives me a chance for an hour a week to talk to these people that I meet and sort of bring it home. Just a week ago, I was in Bosnia making friends and talking with people. And, of course, Bosnia is the fault line, the cultural fault line between East and West in so many ways. We were there, I was just in Dubrovnik, and, of course, that was just a human traffic jam of people off their cruise ships. And I thought, well, this is unfortunate if that's all they see on their visit to former Yugoslavia. I went 2 hours inland to Bosnia and learned about how this was really there's tectonic plates geologically, and there's tectonic plates culturally, too, where you have big things rubbing together. And, you know, Bosnia and Yugoslavia, that's where the Ottoman Empire met the Habsburg Empire. It's where Cyrillic alphabet meets our Latin alphabet. It's where Islam meets Christendom. And it's no wonder that's where there are problems of people living together. Just 15 years ago, Mostar, the big city in Bosnia, was a civil war. It was a horrific thing. The front line was the main boulevard through the center of town, and people were killing each other. The parks today in Mostar are completely filled with tombstones, all with the same year on them, 1993. And I got to talk to people who were living through that horrible war time, when they stayed inside during the day, they went out at night dressed in black, running between alleys so the snipers couldn't pick them off. And then I went to the boulevard, which was the main sort of the front line, and I realized 15 years ago there was corpses lying on this. They couldn't go get their shot down loved ones for fear of getting picked off by the snipers. Today, just 2 months ago, the first restaurant reopened on the boulevard, and I got a chance to eat dinner there and talk with the man who started it, surrounded by these images of this conflict. I mean, the call to prayer and towering church spires and little kids learning to ride their bicycle with trainer wheels and old people looking out bullet-pocked buildings, remembering the change and hoping they can get it figured out. That's very poignant stuff, and it was a beautiful travel experience for me. It was completely safe. It was completely accessible, just 2 hours from Dubrovnik, where there's millions of tourists, and it was cheap.
And that's fascinating, because many of us, if we have not traveled to those countries, wind up retaining only the images that we have seen on the news of civil war and military action and people being shot in the streets.
Well, that's why I'm so thankful I went to Iran a year ago, because now when I look at the news, I have a little different take on it than somebody who's not had the chance to go to Iran. Right now, you see the big rally where they're all pumping their fists up in the air and saying death to America. Well, I was in Tehran a year ago with my public television crew, and I was in my car stuck in a big traffic jam in Iran, and suddenly the driver just burst out, death to traffic. And I thought, what? I thought it was death to America. And he said, well, in Iran, anytime something is frustrating to us and out of our control, we say death to that. So I have a little better understanding of when they say death to something, they don't, you know, it's like when we say damn something. Mm-hmm. We don't. If we say damn those teenagers, we're not really wanting them to die and burn in hell for an eternity. It's just after midnight, turn down the music, you know. Now they're probably saying death to election fraud. In fact, they're saying death to Mousavi and death to Ahmadinejad, depending on who they are. But that's just how they say damn you, and they say that a lot apparently. But, you know, I went to Iran, and I wanted to humanize the place, and it was a beautiful travel experience.
Talk about how people treated you. I need to also say, Rick, our listeners can join in the conversation. All you have to do is call us at 292-8513 or email us at openline@wosu.org. Talk about how people treated you as an American. Once they found out you were an American, mm-hmm. What was their attitude and how did they treat you?
Well, one of the reasons why I wrote Travel as a Political Act is because I wrote a 50-page journal from my experience in Iran, and I thought, you know, this is fun reading. I thought it was really interesting what I learned. So that was a major chapter in this new book, Travel as a Political Act. And one thing I was impressed by when I went to Iran is how afraid I was when I first went there. We We nearly left our big TV camera in Athens and took in our little sneak camera because I thought people would be throwing stones at us when they learned we were an American film crew. When I got on the streets of Tehran, I honestly have never been received anywhere more with a warmer welcome than I was in Iran when they found out that we were from America. People didn't like our president, that's for sure, and we don't like their president. But, you know, people are going to be there long after the presidents are gone, and I just wanted to humanize the thing. I remember being stuck in a traffic jam in Tehran, and there's a lot of traffic jams in Tehran, and I was just sitting in the back seat patiently, and the man in the next car indicated to my driver to roll down the window. He handed over a bouquet of flowers, and he asked my driver, he said, "Give this to the foreigner in your back seat and apologize for our traffic." I just thought that was incredible. It never occurred to me that somebody would feel bad about their traffic jam for a visitor in their country.
Right.
You know, the Iranians are, it's hard to imagine this for a lot of Americans, but Iranians are motivated by the same thing we are, and that is fear and love. And I had, you know, a lot of parents over there are scared to death that their children, if Western influence is allowed to creep into their society, that it'll kidnap their children and turn them into little, their girls into boy toys, and make them all drug addicts and crass materialists. They have very high ideals from a morality point of view for their children. I had a woman actually walk across the street and tell me, "We just don't want our children to be raised like Britney Spears." And I said, "Neither do we." But, you know, they're the victim of a lot of propaganda over there, and we're the victims of a lot of propaganda here. And, you know, from a, you know, just ethically, I believe that a country should know people before they bomb them. You know, we may have to kill somebody with our bombs, but I think it should hurt. And I really believe
it
that
should hurt us, the ones doing the bombing.
It should hurt whoever, you know, if you're going to bomb somebody, you should feel a pain about it. Sometimes it's necessary, but I just think it's good character not to dehumanize your enemy, which is the inclination of a government. Whenever a government is going to go to war, they try to dehumanize their enemies so their compassionate, you know, good people won't lose sleep over it. We all felt so sad for the cute blonde girl in Aruba who was kidnapped because she was very humanized. What was her name? I mean, there's
I know the case you're talking of,
yeah,
and
I mean,
offhand, I cannot think of her name.
You know, it's like the little girl that fell down the well a decade or two ago, and we spent millions of dollars sending her get well cards. Well, there's
it was Natalie Holloway.
Natalie, that's right, you know. Well, Natalie is precious, but so is the little girl that was killed in the wedding party in Baluchistan when one person was tall and they thought it was Osama bin Laden, so they just killed everybody in the wedding party with one of our drones.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we need to kill every little group of people with a tall guy in it, in this case we might get Osama bin Laden, but it should hurt, and if it doesn't hurt, then you don't really understand the humanity of this planet. When you travel, you realize that you know, the people in Iran love their children as much as we do. When you travel, you realize that the average lot in life for a woman is to walk 5 hours a day to get water for their children. They don't even have any time to be home to take care of their children because while they want to be mothers first, they have to even more fundamentally than that get water for their kids. And it's just, you know, $10,000 and you can drill a well for a thirsty community, and then all those moms can stay home and love their children. It's not a guilt trip to acknowledge that, but there's something wrong with somebody who goes through life not understanding that half of humanity is trying to live on $2 a day, and there's some beautiful love that's being denied in that area. And if people are interested in contributing to our own national security, if that's what motivates them, I'll tell you, you can do a lot of things with what's being called soft power, you know, sharing our ingenuity and our technology so people raise their children not angry and frustrated and hopeless, but with reason to contribute and be constructive. That's an exciting thing about traveling, and when I've had a chance to travel anywhere, it reminds me that the variety on this planet is not something to fear, but it's something to celebrate.
And we have some callers on the line who I think want to share their experiences. Let's talk to George. Hi, George. You're on Open Line.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Mr. Steves, my wife and I just recently returned from a cruise. We don't typically think of ourselves as cruise people, but with the dollar, the rate, you know, the exchange rate in Europe being what it is, and the price of lodging and meals in most of the Western European cities, we found that cruising, for all its drawbacks, is a pretty economical way to get around. But what we do is tour guides ahead of time to take us around, and it's really worked out great for us. And as a matter of fact, when we went to Ephesus, we had the luck of having Mina, who I believe is one of your tour guides in Turkey, and she did an absolutely fabulous job of explaining Ephesus to us and taking us to lunch at a beautiful family-run restaurant where we were the only North Americans in the whole restaurant. It was absolutely outstanding.
George, that's brilliant. Was that Melly that you had in Turkey?
Nina.
Nina.
Yes, Mina.
Nina. Now, George, you're doing something that's just, I think, really smart. And cruising is more economic now relative to ground transportation, hotels, and restaurants. So more people are making that decision, like you did, to travel using that as the shell of the experience. But then it's critical that you leave the mob scenes and you hire your own guide or get your own car or just walk past all the groups and hop in a taxi and do your own thing like you did. It's probably no more expensive than all the sheep following the ping pong paddle with the number on it for that cruise tour, but you had a much more real experience, I think.
Yes, we did. And also, as a Hungarian, an American of Hungarian descent, I have to ask you to be mindful of something in your pronunciation of Hungarian names. As in English, where PH means an F sound, in Hungarian, GY means the J sound. So MAGYAR is Magyar.
Magyar,
or GYORGY is George.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm really bad with my pronunciation, so I appreciate that. I'm doing my best on that.
All right.
No problem. There's no way you could know that.
Good, George. Hey, my hope is to, in the next couple of years, to write a guidebook to help cruise travelers like George leave the mobs and take advantage of what the cruises give them economically. But when you get on land, to not be crowded with thousands, literally, of people that are just congesting the tenders as you get in and out of port.
Uh-huh.
I was just in Dubrovnik a week ago, and I couldn't film in the middle of the day because the main drag of Dubrovnik was a human traffic jam of cruisers. And it really it put me in a real funk. And then, thank goodness, at 5 o'clock, everybody was out back on their boat. And Dubrovnik took back its real charm.
We're going to have to take a little break now, Rick, but don't go away. We're going to continue our discussion after a few announcements. This is Open Line on WOSU 820 Columbus.
WOSU News reports on the stories you need to hear and the stories you want to hear.
At a time when Columbus is considering laying off nearly 300 police officers, can it afford 6 helicopters?
When you don't have the resources and you've got to make cutbacks in your operation, that's one of the places that you should take a close look at.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Currently 82 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:30. Stay right here at noon for fresh air. Director Catherine Bigelow and screenwriter Mike Ball talk about their new war thriller, The Hurt Locker. It's about an army bomb squad working in Iraq. That's coming up on Fresh Air. It begins at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Facing the Mortgage Crisis is a free town hall meeting at WOSU at COSI tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Certified housing counselors and other experts will be available to answer questions and provide help with mortgage concerns. Visit WOSU.org for more information. And that event again is tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at WOSU at COSI. In the weather forecast for today, sunshine and a high near 90 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 68. Sunshine and a chance of rain for Thursday and a high of 88 degrees. Looking ahead to Friday, sunshine and a high of 89. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. We're talking to Rick Steves, host of shows on WOSU 820 AM. He is on NPR. And he's on public radio. You can hear his show on WOSU 820 AM on Sunday afternoons at 1. He's also on WOSU TV on Rick Steves Europe at various times in the schedule. So check us out online and find out the exact schedule for that. Just before the break, Rick, we talked to George and he mentioned pronunciation. One of the questions I had for you is about language. Do you speak other languages, and how much of a difference does it make if you don't?
You know, I speak only English, and it's nothing to brag about. It's been my sort of persona a little bit, because for 30 years I've been giving talks and teaching people to travel in Europe, saying, you can do it. And if I spoke all the languages, it wouldn't be fair, because they don't speak all the languages. But I'm miserable with the languages, but I speak the language that other people know. This is the world's linguistic common denominator, English. I was just in Iran. I gave a talk about Iran just the other night in Seattle here. And somebody says, they noticed the signs in Tehran were in English and Farsi. And they said that was odd, because aren't they anti-American? Why would they have English signs up? And they're anti-Britain, too. But they don't have English signs because they care about Britain or America. They have English signs on their streets because that's the language of travel and commerce and internet on this planet. So anywhere you go, you'll find English is generally the second language. If a Greek meets a Norwegian hiking in the Alps, they'll communicate in broken English. What Greek speaks Norwegian? So, you know, we're lucky that way, and I've been able to do all my travel speaking English. I don't want to discourage people from speaking the languages, because I think people who do speak the language have a wonderful inside track, much more intimate than mine.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't, it's just a matter of common sense and decent politeness to care enough to learn the nice words, and people really appreciate that. I was just in Montenegro a week or two ago, and people are still talking about the two big rock concerts they've had recently. Madonna was there, and the Rolling Stones were there. And Madonna didn't learn a word of Montenegrin, and she was in her helicopter 3 minutes after her last song, getting the heck out of there. The Rolling Stones learned all the words that I knew. You know, it's just good day, hello, thank you, Ternagora.
Sure, so you can say something in the local language.
And the people just are crazy about the fact that Mick Jagger knew a few words in their language. So it really has an impact.
So it's worth it to do a little bit of research before you go and maybe pick up just a few phrases, the hello and the thank you that sort of thing.
I have, when I'm in my good style, when I'm traveling, I have a little piece of paper in my shirt pocket that has the phrases or the keywords that I'm working on. And I just add a few of them each day. And, you know, it all depends on what you're interested in. When I'm in Italy, I know the word corposo, because that means full-bodied wine. And when they ask me if you want wine, I say, si, corposo, per favore. And they really are impressed by that, and I get a nice glass of wine.
You mean it's not just the fact that you're Rick Steves and you're in their restaurant?
No, they don't know who Rick Steves is, I hope.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take another call. This one is from Peter. Hi, Peter. You're on Open Line. You have a question for Rick?
Yeah, good morning, Charlene, Rick. I have to agree with a lot of Rick's comments about how the different governments demonize other countries. But what I wanted to write about is I have a artist friend who lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and he likes to go to cemeteries all around the world and photograph them. And he sent some really wonderful photographs back from Jerusalem, and there's an Arab cemetery there. And then he went to Krakow, and of course he went out to the concentration camp outside of Krakow, and took some really stunning pictures of people there as they went through. And then surprisingly at the end, there were some Jewish students, and they were very joyous at the end. They were waving the flag of David and showing that they persevere. They're still here. And I thought that was just wonderful when I saw them. Beautiful sepia prints. In fact,
wow.
I told him that I want some copies of those for my own home. They're just beautiful.
You know, that's a very good point, Peter, that a lot of people find inspiration and peace and just beautiful art in cemeteries. There's even a guidebook to the cemeteries in Paris called Permanent Parisians. And I've stumbled onto a few cemeteries in my day that I made sure to bring our TV crew to when we were making our public television TV show. Milan, for instance, has a great cemetery. The cemetery you're talking about, well, I guess you were talking about Auschwitz, but in Krakow there in Poland, there's a powerful cemetery in the Jewish community, and or what was the Jewish quarter, and And there was a horrific time when the Nazi bulldozers came in and just bulldozed all the tombstones. And today they've built a memorial out of all of those broken tombstones to remind people of the horrors of the Holocaust. And it's pretty exciting to think that Jews are standing there now claiming we will persevere.
Yes. Yeah, that's great.
So when people travel, I think it's really fun to take a little detour and go through the cemeteries. I'm going to be in Norway in Oslo next week, and I plan to go to this wonderful cemetery around the oldest church in town. And while you're there, you can remember the big personalities of that culture. In our travels, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Peter, thank you so much for calling in.
All right, thanks, Charlene.
And now we have a call from Pam. Hi, Pam. Morning. You have a question or a comment for Rick?
I do, but one of each. Rick, I think you're absolutely wonderful, and I particularly enjoy the political statements that you've been making over the last couple of years. A lot of us are noticing those.
Thank you.
With appreciation. My question is, I'm a family practitioner, and I have an opportunity to do a locum tenens in New Zealand. I haven't picked the location yet. I'd like to work with the native population there somewhat, but I'd also like to get to see as much of the geography of that country as I can and during the 6 to 12 months that I'll be there. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations.
Boy, I'm afraid, Pam, I don't know anything about New Zealand. I think it would. I know that they've got challenges with their native population like we do with ours. And to be a doctor working there, that would be a very rewarding thing. But I can't help you with any tips on where to go in New Zealand, except good for you to be going down there and having that'll be an exciting part of your work and your life.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
All right. Thanks for calling in. Mm-hmm. Rick, what have been some of the most surprising places that you've been where your impression maybe was completely jangled, completely shook up, or where you were surprised at how much you enjoyed it?
Well, for years I've been calling Tangier in Morocco the armpit of Africa. And I got that impression back when I was a student traveling, and I didn't really know why it was the armpit of Africa. It was just a hole. It was horrible, Tangier. It's just across the Strait of Gibraltar from Spain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned now when I'm traveling in my work, I've got local guides, and I've got the responsibility of learning and designing what I learn into TV shows and guidebooks and tours, because that's my work. And I went down there just recently, and I realized from local guides that Tangier used to be such a pit because after World War II, it turned its back on Muslim Morocco and became an international city, sort of a European connection. And a place that was literally disowned by the king of Morocco because of its Western orientation. And it never got any federal money. The king vowed never get to give a coin to Tangier, which is one of the great cities of Morocco. Well, that king is gone, and the new king, Mohammed VI, I think his name is, came into power a few years ago. And his first place he stopped was Tangier. And he said, it's time to bring Tangier back into the fold. And he respected Tangier. Tangier's getting financial support from the government. And there's a pride in Tangier that just blew me away. And I went down there in my guidebook research work. And for years, I was saying, you know, the only way to do it comfortably and safely is just hold your nose and take one of the day trip tours with all the timeshare condo people from the Costa del Sol, side tripping over the Strait of Gibraltar to buy a carpet and see a belly dancer and go home. And I thought that was the practical way to do it. And now I went down there and I realized that's no longer good advice. And you can go down there very easily in an hour and a half on the fast boat from southern Europe, and you can have an incredible day in Africa, in Tangier. I was down there crossing paths with these tour groups, and I know every time I was without them, I was having a great experience, and every time I saw them, they looked like a bunch of nervous kangaroos with their day bags on their bellies so they wouldn't get ripped off, you know, wearing them on the front.
Uh-huh.
And I knew where they all went to the same lunch place. They all had this crass belly dancer. They all went to the same carpet shop. They all bought their carpets. They went through the same spanking line back to the boat with everybody trying to sell them little knickknacks. They got back onto the boat so thankful they weren't ripped off, they didn't get diarrhea, and they had their carpet, and they got back to Spain, thank God. And I just thought, self-imposed hostage crisis, that's what I thought. What a horrible experience they had compared to what I was having, sitting cross-legged on the roofs of buildings, sipping mint tea, learning to play their fun instruments and the combos and wandering through the souks and see how they tan their leather. I just was having the time of my life because I had the nerve to go there on my own, and I had a chance to hire a local guide and learn what the new king was doing for their society. And what was interesting to me was I was in an affluent Arab city, a place that was stable, that loved its king and had an element of democracy that had completely different standards than me. I mean, they treat their women differently than we treat our women, that's for sure. And I wasn't going to go in there and try to change them. I just was excited that they got out of bed in the morning not even thinking about the United States, not thinking good about us or not thinking bad about us. They were doing their own thing, and it was a real beautiful experience for me.
That sounds fascinating, and I'm curious, too, when you're traveling like that, are you just by yourself, or how many people do you normally travel with?
Oh, hopefully I'm just by myself. I'm not, you know, I don't, when I'm working, I'm very focused. I'm going on Monday to Norway, and I'll be in Europe for 50 days, and I'll work 50 days in a row for 12 hours or 14 hours a day, and I'll come home feeling healthier and younger and more alive than when I left. I'm so thankful I found my niche, and updating and researching guidebooks is pretty amazing process, because you know that 10,000 people are going to base their trip on this book next year, and I can't just hang out in the hotel watching a movie. I got to get out there and check out all those restaurants, because people are going to look at my book next year and want to know which restaurant experience is best. And there's going to be people who want pizza. There's going to be people who have had too much pizza. There's going to be vegetarians. There's going to be people with more money. There's going to be bohemians that are picnicking. And I want to find out where the best place to picnic is and where the best place for a splurge is and where the best place for a vegetarian restaurant is, and if it's a tie-dye restaurant or if it's just a classy restaurant as far as vegetarian style goes. And all of those challenges are mine when I'm traveling. And then I meet my film crew, and then we get to scramble and make those shows. I mean, a year ago, I was in Bosnia learning about all the struggles as they recover from their war and everything. And mm-hmm. I learned so much, I just said, I got to come back with my public television crew. And so just last month, we were in Bosnia and in Montenegro learning and putting it into the TV show. And boy, that's why I'm just so excited that I can bring home those TV shows, and people can in Ohio can enjoy the lessons I've learned from my travels.
Absolutely, because we carry your show on WOSU TV, and it's at various times, so you have to go to WOSU.org to check the schedule. But we also carry Travel with Rick Steves here on WOSU 820 AM. That's on Sundays at 1 p.m.
Charlene,
we get to get those tips right from your programs.
Charlene, I know this is not pledge drive time, but I got to tell people who are listening that who appreciate travel, that as a producer of radio and television for public television, I'm so thankful that I can write scripts and put together radio shows that assume people have an attention span and that respect their intellect and that people who want to be challenged. And I can bring home content regardless of what the advertisers think. You know, I get to actually go there and bring home what I think is the pithy reality of workaday life in the street. It's not lifestyles of the rich and envious. You know, it's lifestyles of you and me and how the rest of the world is living. And as a producer of radio and television, it's just my stuff would not see the light of day anywhere else on the dial except in a station like WOSU.
And those of us who work in this industry certainly do appreciate that. And I think our listeners and our viewers really do, too. And, in fact, let's take a call here, Rick. We have John on the line now. Hi, John. You have a question for Rick?
Yeah, Charlene. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Rick, let me say I'm a huge fan. I've been following for you for years, and I just have the utmost admiration and respect for what you do, and you're very insightful.
Thank you.
My fiance and I both are just really in love with all of your programs that you put together. My question is, my fiance is German, believe it or not. She's a school teacher in a town that I'm pretty sure you've been in probably many times called Trier, about mm-hmm. 45 minutes away from Luxembourg.
Yeah.
She has a great job. She's a school teacher. She works for the state. I'm here in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm a server at a restaurant, and I paint in the morning. I cannot mm-hmm. speak German, and I really have no other skills or trade. I want to get to Germany, and I need to get a job. It's to my understanding that I have to have what they call their social security, which is more or less like health insurance. And my fiance tells me if I was to pay for that out of my own pocket, it'd be something astronomical, you know, 300 to 400 euros a month. But if I'm enrolled at university, that would be cut tremendously, maybe 50 euros a month. My question for you is, do you have any advice or any suggestion or any leads or numbers or websites that I can go to try to get a job, an American job, you know, American having a job in Germany, somewhere near Trier or Luxembourg? And is it possible for me to enroll at university, and what steps should I take?
Well, John, those are questions way beyond the scope of my guidebook for tourists.
Yes.
I will tell you that Europeans have unemployment just like we have unemployment, and they're not eager to employ an American if it will unemploy one of their people. So my understanding is if you want to get a job permit or something like that, if you can demonstrate that you've got skills that you bring to the country that will not unemploy a local person, but that will complement the industry, that'll help you. A lot of Americans, just in practical terms, they work under the table in Europe because they can't get a legal permit, and they do things in the tourist trade, and they're not very well paid because they're being paid in a way that the local businesses cannot declare that payment. And I don't think you're looking for that kind of part of the economy, but that's how kids get employment. They'll be selling jewelry and leather works in Florence to other tourists, and they're hired by local merchants because they speak English and they're good salespeople. You might want to, there's a lot of American military, I think, in the area around Trier.
Yes.
And you might want to look into that and see if there's any sort of employment related to an American military base. Otherwise, I don't know, but it sounds pretty exciting. Trier is a great city. It's one of the oldest cities in Germany. It was the capital of Charlemagne, I believe. It was called Aix-la-Chapelle in the year 800, and that was really functioned as the capital of Europe for a while. And I'll be there in about a month, and I just love going there and researching because it's got the best Roman architecture, ancient Roman architecture in Germany.
All right. Good luck to you, John. We hope that things work out for you. Appreciate your calling in.
I just remembered I made a mistake there. It's not Trier. It's Aachen. That was Aix-la-Chapelle. Aachen is near Trier.
Oh,
Trier is,
okay.
Trier is famous for its Roman history, but Charlemagne, who was the first really European king, he made his base near Trier in the town of Aachen, A-A-C-H-E-N.
Okay. Good catch.
Yeah.
We have a call now from Deb. Hi, Deb. You're on Open Line.
Hi there. Rick, first let me say that I love your books and I love your radio program. And my family and I are avid travelers with my 10 and 13-year-old children who march through the airports with their backpacks on.
Wow.
And we've had a fabulous time. But the reason I'm calling is we have lived in New Zealand. My husband's a physician. And my 10-year-old was actually born there, and he did the locum tenum program. So,
just like Pam who called earlier, huh?
Exactly, and that's why I was calling. If she is looking at working in New Zealand, and she specifically wants to work with the native population, the biggest cluster is in the Rotorua area, which is on the North Island, and it's in the central part of the North Island. So we lived in Wellington for 2 years, and if you ever want to go to New Zealand, you can call me and I'll give you some tips.
Wow. Well, Deb, I think Pam will be interested in that. I don't know if you guys can connect, but that's great that you have that experience. I bet it was an interesting experience for you to work there that way.
I actually only worked there for a year because I'm not a physician. My husband's the physician.
So, oh, okay.
But it's a wonderful country, and we've traveled much more in that part of the world than we have in Europe, though we've been to Europe.
You know, that's
as well.
That's my only gripe with my work is that I've decided because I'm of the number of people that are using my material, I'm going to focus all my travel energy on Europe because for me that's the wading pool for world exploration. But my favorite countries really are India and Indonesia and Thailand and Sri Lanka and Japan, places I've enjoyed traveling where I wasn't working. And you know, this world has so much to offer. And it's just important that travelers recognize the fact that you need good information from other people who've been there first so you can enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar.
All right. And, Deb, thank you for your call. We have a call now from Martin. Hello, Martin. You're on Open Line. You have a question for Rick?
Thank you, Charlene. Yes, I want to compliment Rick on what he does for National Public Radio and public broadcasting. He's always given quite a bit of his time, and I appreciate that. We were in Umbria and Tuscany a couple of years ago, and it was kind of funny. We'd walk around the corner, and here'd come somebody else with Rick's guidebook in their hand. It was almost like the monks in the courtyard reading the from the book. I wanted to ask about the mechanical nativity scene in Assisi. I looked for it near the more modern church or out in Midtown, yeah. and didn't find it.
Oh, you know, Martin, I was just in Assisi last month doing my research, and I follow my book like a tourist would, and I go to every place in my book and check it out and have to update it. And
where you said there was a chain across the road and don't pay attention, that was there.
Oh, good, yeah. Well, yeah. What Martin's talking about is there's a sort of an eccentric artist in Assisi, which is the hometown of St. Francis, and a beautiful situation up on a hill, and it's so evocative. And in Italy, yeah. And you're walking around doing all this great Franciscan sightseeing, and it's just kind of quirky to find this goofy Monty Python-esque little mechanical manger scene. And I love to my travelers love to find those quirky little insights into the contemporary life. And but he was sort of he was fun for the tourists, but the locals thought he was kind of crass and nothing to be proud of. And apparently they kicked him out of his little hole there. And his mechanical manger scene is now in boxes somewhere. And I had to take it out of the new edition of the book, Martin. But you know the teaching lesson of that is you're in the town of St. Francis, and St. Francis was a very creative teacher. Him and his followers were called jugglers of God, and they would come into the town with music and with stories and with clever teaching methods so people could better understand the Bible. And according to legend, Francis is the first guy to ever make a manger scene so people could remember Christmas. And so these manger scenes originated in Assisi. Consequently, when you go to Assisi, you do find a lot of manger scenes. In fact, all over Italy, cities are proud of their presepe. That's the local word for manger scenes. And when you go to Rome, you wander around, and every church has a wonderful manger scene. And in front of the Vatican on St. Peter's Square is the biggest manger scene, I think, in the whole world. It's the size of a regular house, and with a towering Christmas tree next to it. And it all goes back to St. Francis.
Well, you're probably going to be, a lot of people think the comparison is irreligious, but you're a pretty good teacher yourself, Rick, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for your comment about the value of public television. You know, I spend a lot of time helping out TV stations and radio stations during pledge time because my wife and I have raised our kids with public television, and I recognize it both as a consumer and as a producer of programming as a precious part of the fabric of our communities. And I really believe it's just flat out good citizenship to support it in any way we can. And one way I support it is by, making myself available during pledge time to remind viewers and listeners of the importance of this.
All right, Martin, we certainly appreciate you calling in. Rick, we have an email now from Angie. She says, have you read Maya Frost's Global Student? We have a 16-year-old and an 11-year-old and are considering a global education for them. What is your opinion on, quote-unquote, stepping off the track and moving or living abroad to complete a high school or college degree? Do you have any countries or programs to recommend?
Wow. I think that's pretty radical, and if you can pull it off, more power to you. You're going to have a child who's a citizen of the planet, as well as probably a more thankful American. I think that's a rich opportunity. It's probably more than what most parents are doing, and I'll tell you, I think the beautiful thing in education right now is the enthusiasm schools, high schools and colleges have for getting their kids some foreign study experience. I never had that. Both of our children have spent time studying abroad. Andy spent a semester in Rome and just had an incredible experience. And Jackie, when she was in high school, went with her high school class to Morocco, and with no computers, no iPods, no cell phones, not even a camera. And they stayed in the in a hill village in Morocco, making friends with local families, becoming part of local families, and learning about a Muslim sort of approach to life. And a lot of stuff didn't make any sense to her. But she came home, and the world was not such a simple, scary place, but the world was a much more fascinating and real place. And there's lots of ways to do that. And as adults, I think that we can get continuing education through our travels. You know, I've spent a lot of time traveling, and I would imagine the three of the most valuable trips I've ever taken were sponsored by Augsburg College. They've got a program called the Center for Global Education. And when I go to Central America, I want to have connections where I can get in and talk to people on both sides of complicated issues. And I went down there on what's called reality tours, educational adult tours. They put them together for, politicians and different professionals who have a need to better understand people's struggles south of the border. And, anybody can go on these tours, and you come home with a rich understanding of the Middle East or Central America or globalization or desertification in Sub-Saharan Africa or whatever theme you're talking about. And, you know, it's fun to go on a safari.
And that was through what organization was that, Rick?
Oh, that's called the Center for Global Education, and that's at Augsburg College in Twin Cities, Minnesota. And when I wrote my Travel as a Political Act book, which is what we're talking about today, I didn't want to leave people with nothing. I mean, I talked about my experiences, as we've been talking about it in the last hour, in former Yugoslavia, in Iran, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, and so on, and in, of course, all over Europe. And I wanted to do a final chapter about homecoming that talked about how can we employ our new perspective on the planet here as citizens of our beautiful country, and talking about how parents can help their kids to travel and grow up with a broader perspective, and talk about lots of ways that we can employ our new sensitivity as citizens of this country. And one of those things was the importance of supporting foreign study programs for our students.
Absolutely, so they can start getting that experience as soon as possible. We're almost out of time, but I think we can fit in one more question here, if you're quick. Susan is on the line. Hello, Susan, you're on Open Line. Okay, so is this George?
Yes, it is.
Oh, George, I'm sorry.
Okay, hi, Charlene. Hi, Rick.
Hey, George.
Rick, I just wanted to add my voice to the chorus here and say, amen, brother. Everything that you're saying is absolutely the truth. I've developed over the last 12 or 15 years an abiding love for traveling in Europe. And the best way to go is by yourself, because that's when the magic happens. That's when you get to meet people and have those experiences that most people can only dream about. I'll read about the countries when I'm at home and then just go over there and try to experience it. I just love roaming the streets. I got my favorite cities and my favorite countries all sort of picked out, and whenever I get a chance, I'm over there. And while I'm traveling, I try to remember that I'm an ambassador of this country, and at the same time that I'm learning about their cultures and becoming friends with people on the other side of the pond, I'm presenting what I want them to perceive about America. I think that most Europeans have a pretty distinct breakpoint in their mind about the tourist Americans who come in buses and gaggles and then leave, and then the other ones who just come by themselves, and that's the kind they like, and that's when the magic occurs. So all I can say in parting is that you've got the only job in the world that I envy.
Okay.
Thank you.
The only one that I've traded, that I trade for. So keep up the good work, and maybe we'll see you over there sometime.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, George. Okay. Yeah, I think George's comment is so good. The ultimate budget tip, I think, is meeting people. That has nothing to do with how much money you're spending, and that's what that really carbonates your travel experience. And I've been doing this for 30 years now, teaching travel, and when I look back on it, the first decade, Charlene, was all about budget travel tips, and I wrote a book called Europe Through the Back Door, and I was giving lectures on that. Then in the 1990s, it was all about appreciating the art and the history and the culture, and I was lecturing on that, and I wrote a book called Europe 101, Art for Travelers. And in the last decade, it sort of slipped up to what I think is the highest goal for travelers, broadening our perspective through travel, and that's what I've been talking about. It's been in my radio and TV shows quite a bit, and now I've written this book called Travel as a Political Act, and it's kind of like the natural evolution as we slide up and find the higher value of travel, and I hope that through this book I can inspire Americans to go over there and still have fun in the sun on the beach, but at the same time come home with a broader perspective and better citizens of our planet, as well as more thankful Americans.
Rick, we certainly appreciate you being with us today. We've enjoyed the conversation. We apologize to everyone whose calls and emails we didn't get to, but we're out of time now, so we're going to have to say goodbye, but we look forward to talking to you again, Rick.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Charlene. It's been a joy talking to you and your listeners.
All right. And you can see Rick's programs on WOSU-TV or listen to Travel with Rick Steves on WOSU 820 AM Sundays at 1. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new war thriller, The Hurt Locker, is about an army bomb squad in Iraq. the risks that the men take, and what the work does to them. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with screenwriter Mark Boal and director Catherine Bigelow. Boal is a journalist who had been embedded with a bomb squad in Iraq. Bigelow also directed the films Blue Steel and Point Break. The body of every soldier who dies in Iraq and Afghanistan gets an autopsy and CT scan, and the families of those soldiers can receive copies. This policy was instituted by Captain Craig Malik, chief of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. He performs some of the autopsies. He'll tell us about the work and its importance to families and medical researchers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.